Hello. Wow, it's amazing. I guess Kathy Acker is apparently undergoing some kind of resurgence I was unaware of. Well, I was working at City Lights Books, and I think my first research, I had done Search and Destroy, which I thought chronicled the very beginning of the international punk rock cultural revolution. And I think I was on my way towards being way more oriented towards noise music or industrial culture. I mean, I was already probably thinking of the Industrial Culture Handbook, although it hadn't actually begun. And this is after I did Search and Destroy. I got hired by Rough Trade Records to launch the first Rough Trade store in America. And so naturally, being lazy, I rented a place 100 feet away up on Grand Avenue. I'm not a fan of huge commuting. And so they turned out to give me the money to pay the publishing bill. Somebody did, Jeff Travis. It's all kind of a little vague, but I couldn't believe it. I had a dream job. I could sort of get paid to publish. That's the only time that's ever happened. But of course, I had to work at the record store I started every day. So any publishing had to be done after 9 to 6. And I set up things there so that I guess people could illegally stay in the store, you know, people from other countries, and bands came and toured, because that's what Rough Trade was promulgating. Bands like, you know, Cabaret Voltaire, Young Marble Giants, they came here, and I guess I set up some gigs for them, that kind of thing. And Joy Division, they were all set to come, and then the guy killed himself. So they delayed it, and then they came. And they came to my living room, which you weren't able to sit at because of COVID. But anyway, I worked on the first research tabloid, which had J.G. Ballard and Throbbing Gristle. And I don't remember. I need to get that out and look at it. I haven't looked at that in forever. But the point is, I put out a tabloid called RE/Search, but it really imitated or in format the Search and Destroy, which was like, well, they call it a tabloid. I like doing that format because you could make a huge centerfold of someone, like, I don't know, a band or something, and people could put it on their walls if they were so inclined. And so I got this tabloid out, and of course I'd heard of Kathy Acker because I read everything. And one of the virtues of working at City Lights Books and being in charge of the magazine returns was that a lot of the returns I did, I only had to cut out the masthead, and I could take the magazine home. So I read all these magazines, like, freely, shall we say, bad pun. And the first one came out, and you know, it was kind of a slightly uncertain time culturally. It was like, I hate the word post-punk, but that's what was in the air, like noise music more, music involving electronics more, and more synthesizer usage, which was kind of beyond affording for a lot of people, but not everyone. And anyway, the shift I picked at City Lights was one in which I could kind of work the least, which was, I guess, Saturday 9 to 6, Maybe it was Sunday 4 to 12 and Monday 4 to 12. But on one of those nights, that's all I work, and I still could pay the rent and make minimum income. And my rent then was $37.50 a month? And or was it? No, by then it had gone up to $100 a month. Sorry. Because in 79, I moved to where I am now. And so I was working. And then this girl identifying herself as Kathy Acker came in and handed me a copy of my own research. But what she had done was she'd put these large rectangles inside. The outside looked the same, but inside she'd put these large rectangles of her own text. And I don't know, I just thought it was really funny. So we kind of instantly became friends, shall we say, in a generous use of the word friend, because we started talking, and I agreed to publish a book by her. So then she started coming over, and I didn't have my full search and destroy staff then, but these people named Enrico and Stanley decided to come over and do the book. Gave them the job of layout and design. And so we did the book. This is before the first research came out that had Burroughs on the cover, which is the one that everyone identifies with me, not the tabloids. It was a very unfortunate thing that happened. I was also working on the Burroughs issue, and at the same time, I sent the Research 4-5 with Burroughs on the cover and Kathy Acker's book to a printer, and sent the printer a whole bunch of money. And unfortunately, the printer chose that exact moment to go bankrupt, and he sent me a few copies, I can't remember, not very many copies of the Kathy Acker book called Great Expectations. I don't know if this is in any history books to any great extent, but I'm telling it like it happened. And that kind of wrecked my relationship with Kathy Acker in a way, because the book did not come out as hoped. So then I had to somehow raise a ton more money, and then I was able to get my Research 4-5 printed elsewhere in Michigan, and I said, I'm never trusting an independent printer again. And Kathy Acker I gave her the flats for Great Expectations, and then she took them to Grove Press and talked them into printing, because all the work had been then done, the typography and design, and they probably changed the cover a little. I don't even own a copy of whatever Grove Press did. Based on my typography for Great Expectations, but I did see Kathy Acker a few more times. I wish I'd taped her more. I had or taped her a lot more. I know that I've got somewhere a cassette in this house of a lunch we had at a small cafe at Union and Grant and Stockton Street, three blocks away. But I looked for it. I could not find it. It must not have been labeled at all or something. But maybe I can find it eventually. I hope. I have a whole ton of unlabeled cassettes, and I guess I have to put everyone in a cassette player on the A and B side, searching for Kathy Acker, I guess you could call that project. And of course, Kathy immediately sort of intersected with the research shall I say, culture. Like she immediately befriended Mark Pauline, who was a kind of a very, I'd say, a close associate of early research. I mean, because when I met Mark Pauline in 1978, he had just moved here from Florida. He told me that he had these skills like welding, and he worked on one of those oil stations that are on metal out in the ocean, and learned how to weld and do metal work. And he had a great idea to start making these huge machines, and they sort of engage in mock warfare, or what they really do is they destroy huge props he made, you know, buildings or whatever. And we thought Mark Pauline was where it was at, the most avant-garde artist we ever heard of, who invented his own genre of art, which is machine performance. And he did a little show, was it February 79, at a gas station 3 blocks from me in North Beach at Columbus and Filbert. There was a station called Alex's Station. It hasn't been there for many years. But he talked Alex into letting him put on a show there. And there are pictures of it, but I don't think there's video, because video was very hard to come by in 79. Super expensive. No one had it. You'd have to be associated with some university or something, borrow the equipment, check it out, and use it. So, anyway, but Kathy Acker, we had parties, you know, like we had parties at Mark Pauline's house, and or shop, I should say, in 81 and 82. We hosted birthday parties for William S. Burroughs, and that was really fun. I think there's pictures of Burroughs shooting a flamethrower that Mark or somebody in SRL invented. SRL stands for Survival Research Laboratories. And no, there was way more than that that happened. That was also the beginning of the tattooing revolution too. And I don't know, there was a lot going on. I met my friend Mark McLeod, and he was a sculptor, but also he started collecting LSD as art, not as drug, but as art. And boy, he got into a lot of trouble for that. But he had, by some miracle, justice prevailed, and he didn't have to do jail time. But that was pretty Harry, I think the FBI or somebody rented a house across the street from where he lived and trained a camera on him, just monitoring everything, convinced that they had found some huge drug operation, and it was just art. These are the kind of people that we were associated with. People doing stuff I don't even want to mention, because it was illegal, but you could almost call it art, but not exactly. And I guess the statute of limitations is over by now for stuff that you did in 1980, I suppose, 79, 80, 81, 82, but maybe it's not. Art and crime. I suppose art and crime have probably always been somewhat associated with Toulouse-Lautrec going to whorehouses as inspiration for painting. It's just a pretty mild example. And male artists have often been supported in the bad old days by women with jobs because they couldn't get them or keep them. So, you know, the whole history of avant-garde art and crime probably has not been written, but with an editorial slant like that. Oh, yeah, that's another thing we did that was forbidden. We're, of course, raised in a liberal culture involving the arts, and of course it was, guns were totally off the radar. They weren't even thought of, much less warned against. And so I guess in 79, a bunch of us punk rockers decided to get into guns and go out to the range. And Mark Pauline, he taught himself, even got a reloading setup so he could make super cartridges at home, which, you know, you can do. They call them reloads. And there's all this equipment. And also, I think where Mark lived at least one point, someone, an artist had been murdered, and he took over that place. But of course he armed himself because he didn't want to get murdered too. But Mark was also kind of an artist sitting on an architectural drafting table, you know, which he probably found it somewhere. I doubt if he bought it. So much of our, I mean, like everything in our house practically was found on the street, or my huge table here was $15 at Salvation Army. That was, you know, back in 79. I mean, it was a way better economy, just to enabling you to work less and somehow kind of live great. I thought great because you had all your so much spare time, and you could just anytime hang out with friends, and there was a lot of there still is a lot of great stuff on the street. I mean, I just found a nice folding chair that kind of matched another folding chair I found on the street that's sitting right here across from me. I mean, people, I guess it's a, you know, prosperous San Francisco neighborhood in which, I mean, you see a million microwaves, but you just see everything. Sofas. I saw a huge down comforter on the street that looked like it cost $1,000. There it was in the corner. I didn't dare take it home, of course. I don't need one, for one thing. We went to the range, and so when William Burroughs came to town, we thought it'd be real exciting to take him to the range, get pictures. So they all came out in my 1981 Research 4-5, Burroughs holding, you know, a Remington 12-gauge pump-action shotgun and some other esoteric pistols that had just been released. I guess a Glock and maybe an H&K P7, stuff like that. So yeah, there was a handful of us that not only went to the range, but we were reading everything possible. Quick catch-up on history of firearms. I had a different path, though, in my childhood. At around the age of 12, I know, I was 13, but I was probably 12. Someone gave me a ginormous pile of gun magazines, or sporting goods magazines, and I know the exact titles because I, like, memorized the things. They were called Sports Afield, Field and Stream, Outdoor Life, and American Rifleman, which is published by the NRA. So I remember I worked for a beekeeper getting stung a lot, working his extractor machine in the summer when I was 13, and I earned enough to get a gun. And I went and bought one. Then I went and bought another one. Anyway, I guess I shouldn't admit it, but I remember I got in trouble because there was an older boy who could borrow his dad's car, and somehow we took his car out at night, and because this is out in the desert, and we took my 22 rifle, and we thought, oh, let's find some rabbits and shoot them, which I would never do now. I love rabbits, but because if they're caught in the glare of the headlights, it's a perfect time to jump out of the car and shoot them. And so we tried to do that, and we didn't know that a cop had been following us with his headlights off for blocks, I guess. And as soon as we did that, he turned on the siren and the bright lights and took us to jail. But in my small town, there was no jail, so that they had to go, I don't know, 15 miles to a neighboring town, and my poor gun got confiscated. And but we're so young that I think the boy was 15 and a half, because you could get a driver's permit then. And his parents totally forbade him to have anything to do with me after that. Well, I was in a town called La Sierra. It's in Riverside County. And that's where I basically grew up from age 7 to whatever. And so it's like desert everywhere. It's like houses and desert. And a very, very small town with no bookstore, of course. And William Burroughs, he had never met anyone, hardly, who was into guns, but he was really into guns himself. And he was like, I brag that I brought Burroughs out of the gun closet. Ha ha. Closet. And and he'd moved by then from New York City to Lawrence, Kansas, and he himself found other people, gun aficionados, there. And I remember when I went and visited him, I guess that was 88. It wasn't until 88 I spent 10 days with him in Lawrence, Kansas, sort of being his caretaker. And I remember we went out just a few miles from where he lived, and we shot this shotgun. I don't know why we had that instead of a bunch of other different guns, but the thing kicked like a mule. If you ever shoot a shotgun, make sure it is firmly against your shoulder. Don't have any looseness, or you could maybe get a dislocated shoulder. Just a warning. But anyway, I guess Burroughs found himself in a little bit of avant-garde paradise for him at the SRL shop. I mean, the location was kind of isolated, and you could fire guns there and no one would ever come. Police would never come. And you could set out big bombs almost and police would never come. I guess we were all reading as much as possible too, about all kinds of things, like forbidden medical textbooks. And we were just kind of exploring all these things, you know, like, I mean, I know I subscribed to a bunch of magazines. The most fun one was called Police Marksman's News. Every issue had a column and written or spoken / written by an officer who for the first time had been forced to shoot somebody. That's kind of traumatic, you know. People have to get... They all got nightmares after they did this. Every single one. So I don't advise shooting anyone. And, I mean, your dreams are important to you, but you don't want them to be nightmares. And then this gave birth in 1983 to the Industrial Culture Handbook, which is one of my magnum opuses. It was before the internet, and I had to go to everyone's house and write down all the cool stuff in their house and put them in the bibliographies. So that book is, I heard some British reviewer called it the book that launched or inspired 10,000 noise bands, but I thought that number was a little high. But a lot of people, there were certain people, mostly males, who took that book and tried to get every single book and video and whatever else recommendations that's listed in the bibliographies. Pretty much everyone had a bibliography listing all the coolest, weirdest stuff in their house. And that's where we learned the word forensic pathology. Boy, those books are gnarly. And of course, books on venereal disease can be super gnarly. You don't even want to know about some of the diseases out there that aren't so famous. You know, we were after, we wanted to investigate everything that was forbidden. That we didn't even know was forbidden. It just made life fun. And so we discovered weird magazines like Atom Age, A-T-O-M-A-G-E, which is all about these weird people who became vinyl and rubber fetishists, and they made their own colorful clothing and paraded themselves in the color photos. So, you know, there was a lot to learn, shall we say, about the darker side of Western cultural evolution.
Was this period a precursor to modern primitives?
Oh, hell yes. I started modern primitives in 82 because I had dinner with Fakir Muzaffar, this strange man who worked as a Silicon Valley ad executive and made a ton of money. He had a nice house and expensive car and all that down in Silicon Valley. But on his own, he had a large garage all set up with fetish equipment, and so he tried everything under the sun you could do to your body, short of killing yourself, in the search for ecstasy and transcending pain, and I mean he's the guy that. He staged his own Okipa ritual of Sundance Indians putting cords through their chest muscles, you know, drilling holes in their chest and putting cords through the chest muscles and then hanging from trees and hoping they'd see God or something. Not sure what they hoped for. But Fakir was amazing. But it took me till January 89 to finish the modern primitives. Oh, the cat. Hello, cat. Oh. So San Francisco has an amazing cultural, or it used to. Like I had read that where I live in North, called North Beach or Little Italy, I'd read that this whole little 10-block area up on Telegraph Hill where Coit Tower is, I'm more on the lower part of Telegraph Hill, but it's on solid rock. And I'd read that it had been designed by architects and city planners from the city of Genoa, Italy. And it's very Italian. It's like being in Italy. If you walk around the tiny little streets above me, the little alleys, yeah, it's pretty fantastic, I think. It still is. And there's been a lot of complaints about, you know, techies, about techies and other names wrecking the city, but I haven't, let's put it this way, I know that a hell of a lot of artists have, because they weren't like me and just stayed where they're living, they made the mistake of moving. And San Francisco, the only thing that saved me and the city that I know of San Francisco was whoever invented rent control, because they didn't have it in Oakland or Berkeley or other places. And it's the only reason I'm here is because of the two-word phrase rent control, thank goodness. And I know other people have been in their places a long time. And I suppose if you wanted to move to San Francisco when you're relatively young, you should find a person with rent control and rent a room from them or something. Because boy, I mean, I don't know, kids, their kids, I know a few blocks away from me, I heard that this three, it's really a two-bedroom San Francisco flat, which means two bedrooms plus a living room. Well, they ran out the living room as a bedroom, and there's no more living room anymore. I don't know how legal that is, but I guess it's legal. And these three young people are paying $5,500 between them. And I suppose that could go up to $6,000, which means you'd be paying $2,000 a month rent, which techies can easily afford that, but I don't know if everyone can. That seems like a lot of money to me. And so obviously there's like a ton of unoccupied apartments here. I can tell because you walk around at night and only a few of the lights are on in any of these buildings, especially large apartment buildings. Very few lights on. To me, that says that they've got tons of apartments for rent, but no one wants to admit it. But, and also, it's impossible to find any spaces that are abandoned like there used to be in the 80s. Like, there's tons of abandoned areas, buildings, et cetera, and south of Market and all over the city. And places like that, you could put on SRL shows and get away with that without a permit or anything. So there is a lot more freedom in San Francisco in the 80s, that's for sure. You were free to put on an SRL show with explosions, fire, all kinds of mayhem going on, but safe. They were all safe. No one has been killed at a show. And that always made San Francisco special to me. Well, the Buhai Gardens, which is like literally under two blocks from where I'm sitting talking to you. That's on 443 Broadway. I mean, that was the incubation spot for punk rock. Everybody went there and you could meet them all because it's such a small town. It was the only venue that allowed their punk rock to happen. And punk rock was overlapping with performance art. I mean, you could have a girl just put on some noise tape and start screaming and ranting, and that was called punk rock or performance art. And the other place, eight blocks from where I'm sitting, is the San Francisco Art Institute. A lot of wildness went on there, and I don't want to besmirch the Art Institute. I hope that it can be saved, because to me, the soul of the city is the San Francisco Art Institute historically. Like, it's a crime if that place goes under, and yet it's threatening to happen, which is bad for San Francisco. And if you've never been there, it's a really gorgeous physical structure and location and views and everything. And a lot of famous artists came out of it. And it should, if anything, should be preserved in San Francisco. It's the San Francisco Art Institute. But I don't see the city stepping forth and saving it. But it ought to happen. Also, Mills College over in Oakland. Well, I guess it got bought by some other bigger university. But to me, it's a crime that that had to go under, too. That was the headquarters of avant-garde electronic music and inventors of synthesizers, and people were associated with Mills College. I mean, you could Google it all, I guess, and find it. And where else? Well, obviously the SRL shop area, that was definitely the place of some of the best parties ever. But there are other little warehouses where they had great parties. American Can Company, that was solid. Art students from San Francisco Art Institute rented it, and they also had wild parties, no permits needed. And other little clubs, like right across the street from there was a place called Club Foot, and That's one of the places I put on a show with Cabaret Voltaire and Young Marble Giants when they came from England. And another place was 10th Street Hall, where a guy named Paul Ratt, or Paul Bakovich, real name, he put on large shows there. There was also a festival called the Western Front, real early, 1981 or a year like that, which tried to show every avant-garde band in town at one festival. So, I don't know, there's, you know, you can, I guess there should be plaques at all these places. And in fact, they did rename the Mabuhay Gardens. There's a tiny little walkway, driveway there, and they, I think they called it Dirksen Alley, because he's the curator that's most famous for, associated with the beginning of punk rock, even though the first shows of the Mabuhay that I attended were curated by someone else. And, or even the bands themselves somehow set up the gigs. The first bands in San Francisco were called the Nuns, and also Crime, like Crime. And as you know, that happened in the, I live a block away from the Barbary Coast, which is like solid whorehouses, a long time ago, and God knows whatever else went on there that was, well, it wouldn't, there's a lot of things that wouldn't have happened. I mean, everything happens in a weird way that I summarized in a three-word or four-word phrase: first technology, then culture. And I would never have published if, I was a huge Andy Warhol fan way before he was famous. I even went to New York to see his show of like the car crashes and the plane crashes and all that. I guess I went there in 65 or some year like that, or four, one of those years, whenever the show, his first big show happened, to see it. But I had already been a Warhol fan thanks to someone else who turned me on to Warhol. And I started reading everything I could about Warhol, and it was obvious his theorizing and just the most offhanded things he would say could like make your head spin for a loop. And so, yeah, I guess I wanted to be the Japanese Andy Warhol. Bad joke. And when Warhol did Interview Magazine, the first issues, which of course I got, were super primitive looking. I don't know if you can see them, the real deal originally, but they're all black and white, very minimal, and they were done on an IBM, I knew what they were done on, an IBM Correcting Selectric Roman numeral 2 typewriter. It was the first typewriter invented with a second roll of correcting tape built in, so you could easily correct a mistake you made as long as you caught it right away and used the backspace key. So that made into home publishing possible, just as one piece of technology. And but the second thing you needed was photos, and it used to be all you could buy was a Leica camera, really expensive from Germany, but then the Japanese invented their cheap knockoffs. You know, Olympus XA was the one I had. Allen Ginsberg used one too. And it's like, it's an amazingly great camera that you set it a certain way, and you can take pictures really fast in all kinds of conditions. If you set the camera right, you just slide it open and click with one hand. Very fast, much faster than like my iPhone. Taking a picture now takes several seconds. It's too many button presses. So you needed cheap camera and film processing, which had pretty recently been invented, and you needed the IBM Correcting Selectric 2 typewriter. And the third thing you needed was the invention of the cheap tape recorder. Cassettes were 99 cents. Sometimes you could get them 49 cents, and you could make super accurate recordings of interviews. And I used mine to also tape all the early punk rock bands playing at the MAB. I should do something with those tapes someday. And what else? Yeah, those three, and Andy Warhol's vision that you didn't need to be a writer to be a publisher. Because I always have found writing to be really hard. And you could just do interviews with smart people and generate content that way that was fun to read and stimulating, and, you know, imagination provoking. So anyway, when punk started, I had already lived through the hippie movement. I knew there was nothing good ever came out of that in terms of documentation. Everyone was too stoned. They're too high to, I mean, it just didn't exist. And the Xerox machine hadn't even been invented. That's a fourth technology that you needed to publish on the cheap. Cheap Xerox machines, you could go and have your text you generated or photos or anything kind of blown up or shrunk down. And so those four things you had to have to do publishing at home without needing a big office building and a whole bunch of huge machines or whatever. And so because I wanted to imitate Warhol, my Search and Destroy magazine was almost an exact imitation of the first Andy Warhol's interview. And then, I don't know, then I started a typography business in 1980 with borrowed money from one of my oldest friends at that time. He had a trust fund, and he just loaned me a staggeringly large amount of money, but I paid him back in 2.5 years because I started a typesetting business out of my home, and boy, you could make real money with that because there are a whole bunch of ad agencies within a few blocks of where I'm sitting right now, or there used to be, and I just canvassed them all and offered, you know, kind of undercut whoever was typesetting for them before, and got a whole bunch of clients right away, and then I was like rich for a while. It felt like, I remember I had so much money. I started the business in 80 to 81. Yeah, I could do Kathy Acker's book and the Research 4-5 on real typography equipment. And then but I had so much money that in 82, I could go spend a month in Europe getting interviews for Industrial Culture Handbook. And I mainly spent that time in London and Paris, and I had free places to stay. I stayed in the guest room of Genesis P. Orridge in London, Hackney, an apartment that I hated because the only bathtub was in the kitchen, and I'm very private, and I hated having to take a bath when people would come in and out of the kitchen. That totally offended me. But then I had a friend living in Paris, and he had a real job, and he had two apartments, I think, so I could stay in his second apartment. Anyway, it's helpful not to have to pay huge hotel bills. And so anyway, but technologically and financially, it was possible to publish. And so I did, and Warhol showed me the way. And then I eventually got the idea, hey, I want to put out books that look as slick and professional as huge corporations put out. But they always pussy out, as the phrase goes. They always censor their books. They're afraid to have them edgy. And I'm not going to be afraid. So then I did that with research. Oh, it probably started with the rise of the internet, because suddenly all my books were free on the, if you knew where to find them, like, really pissed me off that someone in Poland put my entire industrial culture handbook for free on some website in Poland. Boy, I didn't know how to hire a lawyer and fight it. And I didn't care enough to either, because once you go down the rabbit hole of lawsuiting, you become a more unpleasant person to be around. I advise against suing if you can possibly avoid it. And so, yeah, I think the internet has probably done a lot of damage to what used to be called rare book publishing, because all my books are rare and were rare and still are, all in physical copies. And of course, I feel that it's bad for your eyes and your brain to be sitting all day in front of a laptop or a computer. I think it's bad for your eyes. I think it's better for your eyes if you're reading in sunlight, really real books where the sun reflects off the page in an analog, not digital way, enters your brain through your eyeballs. So we shall see. But you can't, I mean, I have to sell in person as many opportunities as I can just to survive and pay the rent. So I have book tables all over the place. Anywhere I can get a book table, I will be there. And, you know, because the biggest expense in your whole darn life is next month's rent. Ask any artist or any independent person who's not wealthy. Oh, the Nanking. Oh, yeah, I was around when the restaurant opened up, and I don't know how I found out about it, but I was one of their first customers when they were really small. And all they had was a fraction of what they have now, and so you had to sit at a counter, a lunch counter, like old-fashioned diner, but just six stools or something. And then they did have a round table in the back. They might have had a few other small tables behind the lunch counter area, but very small, but you could see all the food being made. But for some reason, these people, man and wife, came here from apparently the province of Nanking, and they called it House of Nanking, and they invented their own cuisine that no one in Chinatown had ever tried. I mean, I know that it was just radical when they introduced yams and sweet potatoes on the menu and other vegetables. I don't even know what they are. Chinese type vegetables, whatever. And you don't recognize what they are, but they're delicious. And the door is opening. And so I went there from the beginning, and I went there every day for lunch, because it's only a block and a half from where I live. I started going there at 2:30, because if I went there, that's when the man and woman owners made lunch for themselves, and they started sharing their lunches, and they were just free to improv all over the map. And my favorite improv dish they ever made and shared with me was sesame oil cabbage sautéed. Sesame gives a delicious flavor, and they added large Bing cherry chunks. Take my word for it. That's a great dish. They never added it to their menu. I guess it's too labor intensive. So I highly recommend the province of, I mean, the House of Nanking to any visitor. They're still great. And they've invented a whole bunch of new dishes, actually. They have a much bigger menu than they used to have. Oh, 1990. Now that's more like it. Things were still wild then. You could get away with everything in 89, 90. You sure can't anymore. in San Francisco, I mean. But one good thing that happened to me was I was so mad when COVID happened because I had reached some tipping point where I was flying all over the world working various art book fairs and then being asked to give talks and workshops and things, and that ended when COVID hit. So I'm mad at COVID for doing that. The plus side is that COVID made possible all these outdoor parklets, which means in front of all the restaurants, they could take over the parking spots, places, parking meter spaces, and set up places to eat and therefore survive. And I think it's much safer to eat outdoors ever than ever eat indoors again, especially in San Francisco, where the weather is good all year round.